seminars and then introduce our speaker for today, who is already there, as you can see here. So public policy is not just about the substance of policy, it's also about public leadership. In other words, it's not just about teaching policy analysis and particular analytical frameworks in classes. It's also about how to apply them in the real world and how to exercise leadership and how to bring academia and practice together. So in other words, like the challenge of public policy schools is to bring the world of academia and the world of practice together. Because like doctors, we are not just interested in diagnosing. We are also interested in call it curing or call it doing something about it. So that's the purpose of our school of the guiding philosophy of our School of Public Policy. That's also the key objective of the policy in practice seminars. In other words, they are aimed at bringing the world of practice into the world of academia, bringing the two worlds together. So engaging with professionals, policy actors, and policy makers to deepen the learning experience and to hear from their experiences, learn from their experiences, both in terms of skill sets, but also in terms of inspiration. And no one could better symbolize these values and this these objectives than our first speaker, our inaugural speaker for this series, Jennifer Musisi. So I know Jennifer for a long time. So Jennifer, for the next few minutes, you can, I don't know, like not switch off or maybe not hear. So Jennifer is a truly transformational leader. When we talk about leadership, when we talk about governance issues, we typically don't think of Africa as a place that could teach the rest of the world in how best to do it. And we usually think of male macho leaders, strong personalities, or like sometime authoritarian leaders, or otherwise like strong personalities. And Jennifer is a perfect example of a transformational, inspirational leader from Africa who has done it and who has not just talked about these issues, but has demonstrated in her work. And let me give you a few examples. So her last posting was as the head of the Kampala Capital City Authority. So think of it as a kind of a mayor of the city. And before that, she was at Uganda Revenue Authority, head of that agency. Both agencies were not known for their performance. And it is widely recognized that Jennifer helped transform both agencies. Revenue Authority in any country, particularly in a developing country, is an extremely tough place to work in, to manage, let alone change. And that's what Jennifer managed to do. Similarly, City Authority in a developing country is an extremely challenging position to lead. There are all kinds of interest groups, all kinds of challenges that I'm sure Jennifer will share with us in a few minutes. She not only managed it, but she also helped transform it. So I work indirectly with her a little bit directly in my former role as in the International Growth Center. When we had this cities in development, like a council, in order to work on issues of cities by bringing with both analytical work, but also public leadership. And we were very proud that the two policymakers there were both women leaders from Africa. So Jennifer and the former mayor of Cape Town, Patricia de Lille. And Jennifer's work I've known both in Uganda and elsewhere has been really transformational. And as a little, call it like acknowledgement of her work, she's currently working at Harvard in the Bloomberg City Initiative, where she's basically teaching the mayors of the world, especially American mayors, on how to do it. what kind of challenges she has faced, what lessons she has learned. So if, for all of those reasons, so I've seen her at operation in Kennedy School also, Harvard also, when I was teaching there. She came to my class. I'm glad she came. And that was one of the most important, most interesting sessions that they had. I think most of them contacted you afterward and Jennifer afterward. So with all of these words, I can go on and on, and I don't want to like embarrass Jennifer any further. But I must say my own personal gratitude that she's, I learned quite a lot from her, both in terms of skill sets, but also in terms, primarily in terms of inspiration. And you'll hear stories about the challenges that she has faced and how she has done it. So without further ado, let me welcome Jennifer. So Jennifer, it was a great pleasure to have you here. I really thank you for coming. So let me say a word about, like, Jennifer is joining from Kampala. Let me say a word. Thank you, Jennifer. So let me say a word about how we'll conduct this seminar. So this will be more of a fireside chat. I'll ask her a few questions. She'll share her perspective, her experience. And then we'll reserve most of the time for you to come in and share your questions, ask her anything to comment or any particular questions. So you can be prepared with your questions, or you can start typing your questions as we go along in the chat function. And Jemima and I will keep an eye on those, and we'll try to bring as many of you as possible. And in between will also be our dean is in another event, so he'll also be joining. He'll also say a few words. Okay, so without further ado, let me turn over to Jennifer. So again, thank you very much for joining. Let me start with your, like, you have a long career in public policy in Africa. That's not the usual place people think of as example of good governance. Can you give example, or can you, your perspective of why a public sector leadership is needed? And what lessons do you draw from your work in Africa, challenges, but also your experience? Over to you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much, Adnan, and hi, everybody that's on this seminar. Thank you for making the time to come, and I hope we'll have a great time of interaction and sharing today. I first of all want to say that there's a lot of very, very well-managed institutions, well-managed communities, and a number of countries that are successful in Kampala and are regarded as successful in terms of performance and outputs. There are also many great high-performing leaders in Africa, in many countries scattered across the continent. But I think the focus today is not going to be on those that are performing most. We want to discuss what is happening with the rest and what we can do as African leaders and leaders in other countries, all of which need good leadership. Whether we are an emerging economy or a developed economy, we need good leadership. And when we look at the institutions in most of these countries that are being discussed by Africa today, we see that economies, institutions, and countries continue to fail, mostly because of weak and inappropriate structures. These structures and policies are often borrowed policies. They are more like a cut and paste that do not speak to or reflect the needs of the people that they are being applied to or the institutions that they are being applied to. And my view is that these cut and paste policies, which are also often quite rigid and non-responsive, difficult to change, changing legislation or policy, at least in my part of the world, is a very, very long, laborious, and tedious process. It could take a year or more before a piece of legislation can be amended to align it to what you want. And therefore, these processes sometimes kill innovation and hamper growth and development. The other aspect, of course, is the aspect of leadership. Bad leadership in terms of mismanagement. And we have situations where appointments are not based on competence, but are based on ethnicity as a reward for political loyalty. Africa has a very highly educated population, which can be very transformative and has been very transformative, as I've mentioned earlier, in many, many places within Africa as well as outside Africa. If these well-educated, very, very skilled, very intelligent Africans are put in positions of leadership and given the facilitation and the space and the support that they need, they would really transform our continent to where we want it to be. So attracting and retaining highly skilled, innovative, and well-motivated staff can actually drive growth and development, as well as bring out the outputs that we desire. The other challenge that is faced is that of the tension between politics and professionalism. This can be quite disabling in a lot of situations regarding good governance, good institutional government governance. Where and the politicians and aim to be one makes decisions that the professional person makes decisions based on evidence, based on research, based on data many times, but the politician is a lot of times vote driven and decisions are
I'm not sure what happened, so maybe her connection dropped. When she rejoins, maybe we can turn off our videos while she's speaking. Maybe that helps. She's joining from Kampala. Hi, Jennifer. Good to see you back. You're on mute.
I'm sorry, I lost the connection just then. So the conflict between politics and professionalism becomes a hindrance to development and to good governance in institutions as well as other social setups that we have in Africa. And the other reason is that political interference is a very big factor in institutional management. It diverts progress, it muddles up transparency, and many times causes paralysis. And that's something that a lot of leaders, especially professional leaders, have to grapple with. And because they are not given the space, they are not given sometimes the support that they need to be able to perform to their best. One of the examples I could give is hiring and firing staff. If good managers are not allowed to hire and monitor and regulate and even fire staff, then they will be hampered in their ability to succeed. Once they develop a strategy and lay down structures, they need resources, both financial and human, to be able to meet their goals. And many times we've seen politicians ignoring and overruling technical submissions or technical opinions in favor of a political decision, even as far as things like staffing or award of contracts or making key decisions that would impact on the success of the enterprise. And therefore, as a result, we've lost a lot of capacity in Africa where professionals are leaving to go and work in more stable, more predictable environments, and therefore causing Africa to lose out on the heavy investment that is made in training its own people. And of course, the big elephant in the room for most places, most institutions, is corruption. I was thinking that perhaps the World Trade Organization or the IMF or the UN or Transparency International or someone should declare the theft of public funds a pandemic, to, you know, with the same seriousness and the same energy that we've applied, say, to COVID-19, and the SOPs being put in place to reduce and limit infection. I sometimes get to a place where I feel this kind of attention and emphasis should be put on fighting the pandemic of corruption, which has become a human tragedy. A human tragedy because it's one of the major things that has destroyed development and caused poverty, caused injustice, destroyed institutions, nations, and done all sorts of ills to humanity. A lot of people die from COVID-19, but I think more people die from corruption-related ills. Deaths because people cannot get good health care or safe infrastructure, people exposed to lack of justice, corruption thriving in broken systems, and many of these systems that are broken in many countries are broken because of corruption. So in my view, corruption is a pandemic. It's a human pandemic that needs to be addressed with the same force. Appointing corrupt leaders and hoping for development is like trying to climb out of a glass bottle. Corruption flows from the top and kills motivation, it kills professionalism, it kills systems. In order for these institutions to be governed properly, we require morally principled, intelligent, honest leaders that can be trusted by the public. And the teams that they lead. If as a leader you are not trusted, it's very difficult to make any impact on your teams or on your environment. The leaders who are great administrators, who put people at the center of their policies and programs and strategies, and people who can build strong, motivated teams need to be people that are trusted. Leaders that can create an environment for innovation to thrive, for people to expand and be at their best. Those are the leaders that we need. And those are the leaders that are being suffocated many times by some of the things that I've mentioned earlier. Leaders need to be change agents, but they need to be allowed to be change agents. They need to be brutally honest, yet inspire hope. They need to be practical. They need to be innovative in order to be able to galvanize the resources that are available to them to achieve the goals that they desire. They need to be, especially in Africa, you need to be able to break the taboos, the barriers, the myths that go around in our communities so much and have a lot of optimism in order to overcome the barriers. So these kind of leaders are rare in Africa, but they are also endangered. They are rare and endangered, and we need more of them. They are some, but we need more. So in my view, those are some of the challenges that we have in leadership and in governance, but we need to hear more stories of success and good governance in institutions and communities, as well as nations.
Great. Thanks for these very great insights, Jennifer. You mentioned hiring and firing. I study personal economics, and one of the big issues in public sector reform is, how do we bring in more motivated people? What do we do with the people who are there? And I I remember an exchange we had many years ago when you were at a seminar here, workshop here at LSE many years ago. And I give that example in my class also. When someone asks you, when you joined Kampala Capital City Authority, there were thousands of employees, how did you manage to change them? And you replied that I fired all of them. And which is not a typical, call it intervention that public leaders do. Oh, by the way, my dean Andres has joined, so I must repeat some part of this. So for Andres, like I'll bring you in a second, but let me repeat what I just said. So we teach, I study public sector reform, and one of the big questions is how do you motivate people? Mm-hmm. And I always bring Jennifer's example that when asked how did she motivate the staff of Kampala Capital City Authority, mm-hmm. she mentioned, I fired all of them. And then she rehired them on new contracts and other things. So I want to ask you, Jennifer, about why you did it and how you were able to do this, given how challenging and tough this is. I work in public sector, and I know that it's extremely challenging. But before you respond, I want to give the floor to my dean, Andres, to say a few words, and maybe you can add something, and then I will hear from Jennifer.
Thank you very much. My apologies to everyone for joining this this event so late, but I was on another call with a Nobel Prize winner, so I had to try to seem intelligent on the other call, and I will try to seem not too incoherent on this call. But Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. As I'm sure Adnan has said, we are delighted and honored to have you in this, which is our first policy in practice seminar of this term. This is we're hoping to make this into an SPP tradition. We've been doing it for about a year now. And the idea, as you're all aware, is to give students the opportunity to meet via Zoom, or someday maybe in person, people who've excelled in policymaking, who've had actual experiences of running governments at the city level or regional level or national level or running government agencies, and who can provide insights, personal insights, policy insights, theoretical insights on how best to practice the craft of government. So we were very, very happy, Jennifer, to have you join us. I don't want to get in the way of the dialogue that Adnan had started already. So I will see if I can chime in later with some comments, but please carry on. Thank you, Adnan. Thank you, Jennifer. And again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Andres. So over to you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
So why thank did you so fire much, your staff and how were you able to do this?
First of all, when you're given an assignment as a leader, a leadership assignment, you need to craft your vision. What is your vision? What do you want to achieve? What do you want to see at the end of your term? Look at it in terms of being given this opportunity. What do you want to see at the end of this opportunity? How are you going to get there? What is your strategy? Who do you need to work with? Who do you need to do the things that you need to get done? And what other resources do you need? And how long? So that's really like laying out a strategic plan as you take on leadership. And it's important to do this because then you can set the pace of what you want to do. You can set the terms of what you want to achieve. And for me, being given this opportunity was an opportunity for me to make a difference. I wasn't looking for a job. I just wanted to make a difference to a situation that I did not like. And that was the situation that the capital city was in. I was embarrassed by the state of the capital city. So here was an opportunity for me to make a difference. And so I documented what my vision was, what kind of capacity I needed, and therefore looked at the legislation and saw provisions for rehiring terminating or rehiring, because the institution was now legally a new institution from that which had run the city in the past. So looking at the legislation, we're able to utilize the provisions to restructure the institution, draw up a new corporate structure, look at the job profiles, the job roles, merge some, discard others, enhance some, look at the salary structure, review it, put it where we thought it would be able to motivate people. And then we began the search for people to match the competences that we're looking for. So we looked for excellence, we looked for people that were motivated and had vision to make a contribution to the transformation of the city. We were not just looking for people who needed jobs or people who needed a better pay. We're looking for people who wanted to be part of the transformation of the city, people who were willing to meet the challenge, because it was a very, very big challenge. So everybody that was in the old institution had to reapply for the new jobs as described and defined under the new structure, and coming, of course, with a different pay scale. So that is how we're able to do it. It was well within the law, and we utilized the provisions that were available to reach where we want. And being a lawyer helped me, because many times people look at the law and its limitations, like, oh, this law does not allow me to do this, this law does not allow me to do the other. I look at it from the perspective of, this is where I want to get. How can the law help me get there? And then take it from that angle. And usually I find a lot of support in the legislation or policies that exist.
So great, Jennifer. So I have a follow-up question. So I also spent a huge amount of years in public sector. Usually people, maybe bureaucrats are risk averse. Many leaders are also risk averse. They usually interpret the law as in a more a risk-averse fashion. So the law requires a process, and almost everything that you want to do as a leader, it can't be done, or it has to be done or at a time scale which doesn't match the expectations that you have set before yourself. How were you able to overcome this problem, this inertia or this risk-averse nature? And in terms of the call it the authorization or political authorization for taking such an extreme step, any lessons that you or any insights that you would give, is it the message that you need to craft your own authorization by working with others? Or is it that you need to take the initiative, be bold and interpret the law or processes differently? If they don't stop you from doing anything, you need to think very differently about so why don't you share your experiences of how you looked into this and what you got out of it?
First of all, I don't believe you can achieve transformation or change without taking risks. There's got to be some element of risk, especially if you're going into a new area or you want to do something that has never been done before. But that risk is balanced with the opportunity available, but also balanced with the legislation to support what you need to do. And it's very, very critical as a leader to utilize the skills and competences that are available to you. In this case, we had a legal team that was able to look at the law, understand the vision, understand the strategy that we wanted to take, look at the law, and ensure that what we did fitted with what was provided for in the law. In addition to that, we were able to coordinate and get support from the other agencies of government that were responsible for our area, so that we had everybody understand what we're trying to do and how we're going to do it, and also provide the provide the checks and balances that we needed before we implemented what we wanted to implement. So the law, one piece of legislation, two pieces of legislation, or a couple of legislations and policies can be looked at. In the extreme case, we also are able to propose amendments, but that is a long-term process, as I mentioned earlier, but that is also an avenue. If you have set a goal and you know the only way you can achieve it is by a legislative amendment, then you have to wait until that legislative amendment is in place. But otherwise, even when you're walking on the tightrope of legality, there is always a risk of someone jumping out of the woods at you and taking you on legally. For me, the confidence was always that what I was doing was right within the law. I wasn't too worried about people trying to sue me or threatened to sue me. I was confident that what I was doing was based on the law, as long as I was sure that was the case.
Thank you. So thinking of legislation as enabling and not disabling. So let me have just one or two more questions before we open up to others. I want to talk something to you about your experience as head of the Uganda Revenue Authority, an agency which was not known for its competence and perhaps also for its integrity, and is still known as a very challenging assignment. So it's partly because there are strong vested interests that don't want to pay, there are vested interests within the authority. How were you able to manage that? And I know you faced a lot of threats and challenges and many threats to your life also. So can you share some of your experiences and what you learned from them? So what insights or what lessons would you give to our students based on your experiences?
Thank you so much, Adnan. In Uganda Revenue Authority, I was the head of legal services, the commissioner for corporate services, and I was working closely with the commissioner general of the authority then. At the executive level. At the time we came in, there was a lot of non-compliance with the law, but there was also a lot of corruption, there was a lot of influence peddling. So the institution was not a very favorable place in terms of professionalism. And the reason I and a couple of other people were requested to join the authority was to try and turn it around in terms of compliance, in terms of integrity, in terms of performance. But it took time, and a lot of what we did was grounded in the structures that we built. We restructured the institution and set up a new organizational structure, a flatter structure, a more efficient structure, and again redefined the job roles and job profiles, and again, as we did in Kampala, requested people to reapply for their jobs and sit interviews to assess their competence and placement. And we managed to get a very good and efficient team that were able to groom. We also spent a lot of time in sharing the vision of where we wanted to get to together. And that's very important because from the top executive of the institution to the bottom person in the organization, everyone should know what the vision is. We should be able to communicate that vision through the ranks and get everybody to see their role and own it, and therefore be able to contribute to achieving that vision. When I was in Kampala, one of the things that used to really make me feel happy about where we're going was when I talked to the lower level employees, like the drivers, the cleaners, and they tell me very, very passionately of how they'd address communities or people in their neighborhood about the vision of Kampala Capital City Authority and where we're going and which roads we're going to do and how much we're going to achieve in this period of time. They fully appreciated where we wanted to get to and felt part of the vision and felt motivated to follow the vision. We also spent a lot of time building the team, creating cohesion, creating a team spirit, and just sometimes basically counseling and telling people the ills of corruption and the need to be professional and the need to take a stand. The other thing that really helped us was to enforce compliance no matter who you were. There were people that were used to not paying their taxes because they were in a certain position in society or in government. Those people were not excused when we went after errant taxpayers, and we got them to pay their taxes. And as you mentioned, sometimes with a lot of threats, a lot of difficulties, a lot of, I think real danger sometimes, real danger and threats to our lives. But because we were determined and we were consistent in what we did, we were able to get high levels of compliance, especially when the public knew that everybody has to pay, everybody has to comply. And when these people trying to threaten us and intimidate us realized we are not going to budge, they backed off and started paying their taxes. We also got some of them arrested and charged and some of them thrown in prison, which was a strong message, but it got the results that we wanted.
Thank you, Jennifer. So I can certainly vouch for the effectiveness of those measures. And I don't want to go into details, but I also remember and recall that your colleagues, and in particular, you were able to do it at great threat to your family, your life, your family. And so a lot of people in Kampala, in Uganda, and around the world have a lot of respect for you for doing that. So let me have a last call it question or comment from my side before opening up. I want to spend give our students most of the time to engage with you. So I want to bring out the gender angle. What kind of special challenges did you face as a women leader, and how were you able to overcome that? And what lessons or what message would you want to give to our students? I see several members of the Women Network here. I saw Awele, I saw Lydia and several others. So how would you share your experience, and what insights did you draw out of those? What lessons would you give to our students, both male and female, all kinds of students?
Both male and female students, but I want to specially mention the women. There are a lot of opportunities that have opened up to us as women the world over, including Africa. And women are doing amazing work. They continue to do amazing work. But in spite of that work, we still have a lot of stereotyping, that cultural shroud for Africa, and I think a lot of Asian countries, there's that cultural shroud that continues to follow us, where stereotyping in roles continues, and women executives have to deal with that. But I just want to say that stereotyping is not going to change soon. I don't think it's going to change soon. And so as women, we need to learn to operate above the stereotyping, above the limitations that are being set by the societies that we live in. Women leaders are running mega operations and big organizations and doing it very, very successfully. I have never regarded myself as a woman executive. I look at myself as an executive who happens to be a woman. And that makes a lot of difference. I have never felt the need to compete with men. I feel complete. I've never felt the need to compete with men, and I feel comfortable in my body. I feel comfortable in my femininity, and I don't let the stereotyping cripple me. We, as women, being excellent at what we do wins us acceptance, wins us the credibility, working to excel, working to show that we can do the jobs that we are given to do, not just because they've been given a favor. We are there because we are good at what we do. We are there because we are excellent. What men can do, we can many times do better, but many times do as much in spite of all the other things that we deal with as women, as mothers, as wives, and all that. We need to overcome the fears of non-acceptance and just keep on the track that we are set on. I want to give the example of a choir director. As a woman, choose your own music, select your own players, who plays what instruments, and conduct that orchestra. And do it so well and with such excellence that the music drowns out all the other noises and washes away all the perceptions. Because excellence cannot be ignored. If you do your job well, you will be recognized and you'll get success. Determine where you want to get and be strong in communicating your vision, communicating what you need to communicate without being harsh or without being offensive. We can strongly communicate our message. And being good gives us the confidence. Being excellent and seeing results gives us the confidence that we need as leaders. When we open our mouths to communicate, the quality of who we are and what we stand for will validate us time and time again. I've seen that happening. I learned very early not to expect favors or sympathy. I learned how to take my stand and do what I needed to do and fight to excel. So our attitude should not be apologetic or, you know, people are doing us a favor to be here. Our attitude should be we're here because we are capable. We're here because we are good. And if you sit in that important big chair, we fully occupy it and do our job and do it well.
Thank you, Jennifer. Very well put. From your remarks, I can't resist the temptation to ask you like a final small comment, which is from Kampala, now you are at Harvard. You're part of the Bloomberg City Initiative. You're now teaching and engaging with US mayors and mayors from around the world. Do you see a difference? Do you see the same challenges that they're facing? Do you relate with their experiences? And can you say something about this particular experience?
It's been a great learning experience for me, especially because I have been able to see the validation of what I have done and been part of in the past in terms of the leadership training and leadership lessons that are given to city leaders and other leaders the world over at Harvard Kennedy School. I've seen what we did without preparation, what we did without full knowledge sometimes, and what we tried out as experiments but got good results. I've seen it validated by data and evidence and theories at HKS. I've also learned the importance of data, evidence to validate and to form a basis for decision making, and how important that is to see the link between the academia and practice, research and practice. The other thing I have seen is, yes, there are very many differences in terms of the society, the culture, the efficiencies that come with being at a leader in the first world, as a leader in the first world, the resources available. I've seen differences there, but there are also a lot of commonalities. There are a lot of things that are common, the challenges we face, the leadership challenges, basically, and each one trying to make their cities better for the people that they lead. So we share quite a lot, but it's also given me a lot of opportunity to learn and gain experience. I think going forward, I will utilize the information and learning lessons that I've got to do more than I did in the past.
Thank you, Jennifer. I'm sure in your future life, you will hopefully even be even more effective. We wish you all the best. Let's open up to our audience. Let me start up with by requesting, asking my colleague Andres to share his any questions or any comments that he has. Over to you, Andres. Meanwhile, I'll request the others to be ready with your questions, comments, and either put a physical hand or the hand function like in Zoom. So be ready with this and indicate that you have a question. Over to you, Andres.
Thank you, Adnan. Thank you, Jennifer, for those inspiring words, really. I think you have you have shared with our students a very good sense of how great, but also how challenging and how difficult being a public servant can be. Especially in a developing country. Adnan comes from a developing country, so do I, so do you, so we have something in common, and we know that being in government can be an exhilarating experience, but also an extremely difficult one. And I just wanted to ask you to maybe elaborate a little bit on this. We have a number of students on this call. They are, MPP or MPA students. Most of them, many of them at some point, all of them, will be involved with public service at different levels of government or with public affairs, maybe not directly as government employees. And I'd like you to reflect a little bit and share with us, first of all, what was the moment when you woke up one morning and you thought, I want to be involved with public service. This is my calling. This is the thing that excites me. This is the thing that I want to do. And also, you've told us about some really difficult times. I mean, I receiving death threats, I think, qualifies as one of those very, very difficult moments that public servants are sometimes exposed to. Share with us that moment when you came home after a long day's work and you thought, wow, that was a great day. A day in which you felt that you had achieved something that, you were proud of, that you'd tell your children about, your grandchildren about, that you're proud to tell fellow citizens about. We've heard about the hard times, but tell us a little bit about the good times in the sense of having the conviction at the end of one very long and hard day that you were in the right business, that you were doing the right thing, that you were making a difference for your country.
Thank you so much. I actually had many good days, depending on which area we were working on. But one of my most, my happiest days were days to do with transforming lives of people. We found the health system in the city in very, very needy shape, the inadequate in all sorts of ways, equipment, the hospital. We had 10 hospitals that were in very, very poor shape, as well as public schools, 87 public schools catering for children from low-income families who would not have an education if these schools did not exist. But these schools, like the hospitals, were in very, very bad shape. So one of the things I started out with was to try and improve both these schools and hospitals. We didn't have adequate budget to do it. government resources were limited and we did not have enough. So I started an effort to improve these schools. Some of the schools had asbestos roofing, which is dangerous, as you know, for children. Some did not have adequate toilets. They didn't have running water. They didn't have desks. Some had reading rooms without desks, so children had nowhere to sit when they were reading. They were really in dilapidated state. If I showed you the pictures, you'd really be amazed at how bad schools can get if they are not taken care of. And so I started an effort to improve these schools, starting with a fund. I started a fund where I was the first contributor. So I committed a part of my salary every month to a fund and encouraged my colleagues in the management team to also make a contribution to try and begin building momentum to improve these schools. That fund grew and we started making some improvements in the schools. But because there were so many, and these were like schools catering for about 80,000 children, we then reached out to corporate entities to help us under their CSR. And then eventually started reaching out to just members of society, in private individuals, schools, businesses, to help us on these projects to renovate schools. So we got private sector participation, we got good people of goodwill, we got organizations, charities, contributing to this cause. We got hardware dealers contributing cement and paint and other building materials. It was just amazing what we got. So every time we went to one of these renovated schools to launch it or to open it, and to seeing the happy faces of children in clean classrooms with running water to wash their hands, with desks and books, was always a very, very high point for me at the end of the day. The same thing for the health centers. We raised funds to expand hospitals, to buy equipment and medicines and build labs, again, through an effort involving private sector and individuals that helped me to do this work. So every time we went and saw mothers in clean maternity rooms, nice clean bed, very comfortable, healthy babies, those were very, very high points for me. And anything that improved people's lives, whether they were youth that were giving projects to help them improve their livelihoods, whether they were markets that were opening for people that had nowhere to work, those were the very, very high points for me.
Thank you, Jennifer. Let's open up to our questions, and I see several hands up. I don't know who went first, but let me start off in the order in which I'm seeing them. So Lydia, Paulo, and then Bethany. So let's start off with Lydia.
Hi, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. First of all, thank you so much for your wisdom. This has all been wonderful to hear. So I wanted to ask about your experience in transformation of your organization. I mean, the firing everyone and then rehiring is already such a complicated sort of project to negotiate. And then you also mentioned that political interference can be really destabilizing to institutions. So I was wondering how you were able to keep your vision consistent despite any political interference you may have had.
Thank you so much, Lydia. The political interference is a challenge. It's a real challenge. But one of the things that I did was to try and keep within my lane professionally, try to stay focused on the vision and the course, and keep communicating to the clients, the public, the team, of what we are going to do, and also to the politicians, helping them try to appreciate what we are going to do. And looking at the law, sometimes you'd get a political intervention that was not supported by law. So we were able to point to the law and say what we're doing is actually what should be done because it was consistent with the law. There were also times when you'd get pressure to do certain things that were not backed by the law. And my answer was simply, I can't do them. They're illegal, I will not do them. Which wasn't an answer that some of my colleagues would give. Sometimes people would get intimidated, but I decided it was better and safer to stick to what was legal and what could be defended, whether ethically or legally or in terms of financial accounting. So the pressures are always there, but you've got to have a certain amount of political support to do your work, and that usually means letting you do your work, letting you do what you need to do. If you don't have that support and say, because you, for example, you prepare the budgets, and these budgets are passed by the politicians in parliament. So you need to have a certain level of understanding on their part to be able to support your budget and pass it. If they don't pass your budget, then you're paralyzed. There's nothing you can do about that if they blocked your budget. So it's a negotiation, explaining to them and helping them understand what you're doing, but also trying not to respond to political interventions that add no value to your work.
Thank you, Jennifer. So I'm assuming it must be a delicate balancing act and difficult negotiation. Having worked in Ministry of Finance as for a number of years, and Andres was in fact a finance minister, so I can only assume that these were challenging negotiations and discussions. Okay, so over to you, Paulo.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Jennifer, for your presentation. My question is around also the politics of the reform, and particularly concerning unions. I'm from Argentina, and at least for South America, trying to do any reform of the public capacity without having the unions on board is very, very hard. So I was very, very interested about knowing maybe the dynamics of the union negotiation and also the kind of support you had from the central government or the opposition.
We had a staff union, but it wasn't as strongly entrenched in the law as some unions I've seen in other jurisdictions, but it was still a body that we had to discuss with and negotiate with and discuss the changes that were coming, as well as the opportunities that were coming. We had political support from government to do what needed to be done, because everybody was tired of the dilapidated city and the things that were happening in the city. Everybody wanted transformation and improvement. And we were able to demonstrate that in order to change the status quo, we needed competent staff that matched the requirements of the task that we had to do. And I'd also just like to say that as a technical person, as a professional person, the safest place for us to be is within the law as much as possible. Sometimes the politics will ignore the law and get away with it. But as technical people, our safest position is within the law. To be able to look at the law, have our legal teams look at the law, and even seek legal advice. Many times we had to seek legal advice, the government advisor, the attorney general, seek advice on decisions that we're going to take or on issues that were before us, just to make sure that we were catered for legally. But having said that, as I Fortunately, we didn't have injunctions when we were restructuring, but some of the other initiatives that we had injunctions, and we have to respect those injunctions and wait until they were resolved in court. So it's a process. Sometimes we have to stop and wait for things to resolve and focus on. I think we've lost Adnan.
I think we have too. So should we move along to the next question? Yes. Which I think Bethany was the next person.
Yes, thank you so much for speaking with us. This is a really great opportunity. My question is having to do with whether you see or drew any lessons from the private sector in your experience as an administrator, whether you see the public and private sectors as being able to inform one another when it comes to personnel and management practices, or if you see them or if you tend to resist those comparisons and see them as more like apples and oranges.
Thank you, Bethany. Actually, we drew a lot of our programs, our policies in terms of transformation, staff capacity building, team building, all those initiatives that helped us build the great teams that we did. A lot of them were drawn from the private sector. We looked at the best performing organizations, not just within our country, but also elsewhere, and drew lessons on how they recruit, how they motivate staff, how they retain staff, how they innovate, how they implement their policies. And we adopted a lot of these practices. Where we saw excellence in private sector, we adopted it and used it so that what we came out with was a government entity that looked very, very similar to a private corporate entity in terms of its functionality, its client care, its communication, really, really good institutions, but drawing a lot of lessons from the private sector.
Thank you. My connection for some reason failed. So over to you, Anupama. I'll also request all of our students to also introduce yourself, give a bit of your background and before asking your questions. Over to you, Anupama.
Thank you. Hi, Jennifer. I am Anupama. I'm from India. I'm a first year MPA student. In the beginning of the seminar, you mentioned how corruption should be declared a pandemic because of how challenging the issue is. And I'm from India and corruption is pretty rampant there. I was just wondering, given how complex and challenging corruption is as a policymaker, where do you even start? There are so many political and bureaucratic factors involved. There are competing interests and incentives. How do you even go about tackling corruption? How do you incentivize the stakeholders to think about the larger picture? So that was one question. I actually had a second question as well. So should I ask the second one right now or?
Jennifer, what do you prefer?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Another question that I had was, so when it comes to urban governance, when it comes to transformation, communities play a huge role. Like empowering communities is equally important. The larger, like the citizens and the larger community is really important. So if you could share a little bit about how did you bring the larger community under this ambit of transformation? What role did they play in pushing this agenda forward?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Corruption is a big elephant. It's a big animal that I think, as I mentioned, is causing a lot of destruction along its path. But dealing with corruption, I believe, starts with the leadership. If the leadership sets the tone for zero tolerance to corruption, for putting in place and monitoring systems to limit corruption, and helping the staff and the teams and the people that you relate with know that you will not tolerate corruption, I think that will be the first big step in dealing with corruption. Setting up systems to reduce human interference or human involvement, like when we came into the revenue collection area, a lot of the revenue was being collected manually. People would come and pay cash. So there's a lot of human intervention. The assessments were done manually. When we put in place a revenue management system, an automated revenue management system, that cut out a lot of the human intervention, but it also helped us to have a system that was easy to monitor, it was easy to account for the revenue, it was easy to communicate with the taxpayers. So that support of the system, that system helped us. But that also goes to efficiency. Where you have inefficient organizations or inefficiencies in organizations, you are opening ways for corruption. And where you create efficiencies and information sources that are predictable and communication sources for feedback from the clients or the public, you are reducing the opportunities for corruption. If the system is inefficient, people will try to bribe workers to get a service. But if it's efficient, they will not have to do that. So don't be and having a hotline for people to report corruption and publicly reporting back on what we had done. But again, it starts with the leadership. Are you going to compromise because you will not punish certain people, you will not take action on others because of who they are or because of what they represent? Being consistent and fair as a leader and continuously giving the message of integrity helped a lot in our case. And the public, after a while, realizes that this leadership and the people under this leadership will not succumb to corruption. They will try in the beginning, they will threaten, they will do all sorts of things, but eventually they will realize that you are not corrupt and they will start dealing with you as a person that they trust. The second one is on urban governance and how we involve the communities. Each of the communities had representatives on the policymaking organ of the city. When we were in the Revenue Authority, we had leaders in the different areas of trade and business that we communicated through, and then we set up specific sensitizations and seminars and public tax awareness sessions. In the city, we set up community meetings similar to village barazas, what they call barazas, where we communicated the vision and the strategy and the budget, and we got the public to get involved in the budgeting process to determine the priorities that we'd focus on during a particular financial year. So there was a lot of back and forth communication, there was a lot of feedback, but of course it's very difficult to satisfy the needs of everybody, but at least we tried to get people to participate in what we're doing through the structure, the leadership and representation structure that was the city.
Thank you, Jennifer. Over to Tangulu. Please introduce yourself and then ask your question, sir.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for your time and the really valuable experience shared. I am Tangulu. I'm coming from Kyrgyzstan, and I'm very interested in the way you actually managed to transform and introduce innovations in the public management. Therefore, I would be interested if you could share, like you've shared a couple of examples already, but if you could add on more of a specific experience in implementing and in designing and implementing innovation in a public settings, and then explaining us what do you think, reflecting now, were the main pillars which enabled you to actually make this, to actually introduce the innovation, because usually countries or public organizations are resistant to change, resistant to innovations, because it requires to learn a lot and to, you know, keep up with the modern technology, which is not really available everywhere, especially in developing countries.
Thank you so much, Tangulu. One of the key things that I attribute our successes to is the team that we had, the staff that we had. We had an excellent team, mostly young people. I think young people have the energy, they are innovative, they are passionate, they have so much going for them in terms of what they can do. And all they need is an enabling environment, an environment which will allow them to innovate, allow them to make mistakes and shield them, an environment that will encourage them to do their best, and an environment that will let them express themselves and share their ideas. And I realize that when you let these professionals do things, innovate, create, make mistakes, start again, eventually you get a very, very good product. You get very, very good initiatives. You get very innovative ideas. I'm one of those people that want to try new things, provided you explain to me what the outcome will be. I'll allow you to innovate. I'll be part of it. I'll ask you where you want me to support you, where you want me to speak for your innovation, and I'll make sure that I participate when you want me to participate, and eventually give the credit to the people that were actually behind the innovation. Our teams as leaders will excel, but ultimately make us excel as the team leaders. They make us, in allowing them to be their best, they make us be our best, if that makes sense. As they excel, we also excel. So a lot of credit will go to the leader, but the people that are doing these things are the people on the team. And many times I'd invite them to share that platform, to take credit for what they have done. I was also very willing to learn. I like learning new things. A lot of, for example, the technology. If we believe that technology is going to help us to double our revenue, as it did, we grew our revenue to close to 200% by the time I left, I will then invest the resources that we have in making sure that we get the technology. But the technology we got had to be technology that we could utilize, that we could maintain, but that would also build on. For example, when we got someone to help us build a revenue management system, we insisted that they would train and incorporate our teams in their work as they built the system, so that they could leave behind teams that could maintain this system. We also insisted that they give us the source code so that we could grow the system to accommodate other functionalities in future, and so on and so forth. So from then, the team that they left behind actually was able to go and help other cities and organizations build their own revenue management system. So opening up to innovation and supporting that innovation will get you incredible, incredible success in very many ways.
Thank you. Over to you, I saw Grace. So, yes, Grace. We can't hear you, Grace. Now you're on mute, but maybe you can unmute yourself. No, we can't still hear you. Does anyone else want to come in till such time that Grace fixes her system? Okay, why don't you write your question and I... So meanwhile, while she writes her question, so Jennifer, like when you look at your life, your public life, you have been in so many different agencies in Uganda. Now you're at Harvard. What do you see as your own like future challenges, and where do you see also the potential of your country, but more likely Africa? So there's a lot of talk about Africa rising, Africa challenges. How do you see the potential for Africa and your own possible role, things that you would want to do to contribute to that vision?
Africa has great potential. We have great potential. We have great resources, human resource, as well as natural resources. So there's a lot of opportunity there. It's like the next big thing in terms of development. And therefore, there's a lot of opportunity for all of us to contribute to moving Africa forward and consistently and very intentionally addressing the challenges that are holding us back right now, some of which I mentioned, that are holding our nations and our institutions back. I'm a person that's motivated by challenge. I like taking on challenges. I like being put in a position to and be required to make a difference. So any opportunity for me to make a difference, to turn a situation around, to make things better for people, to contribute to improving our continent, I would be ready to jump on it. It's my motivation. It's not the positioning or the financial gain or all those other things. My motivation is making a difference, leaving things better than I found them, and transforming people's lives and situations. So that's opportunity that I'm always open to.
Great, thanks. So Grace, I know you have written your question, but if your mic is working, you can...
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you. Okay. So why don't you introduce yourself and then ask your question.
Sure, thanks so much. Sorry about that. So my name is Grace Joel. I'm originally from Australia and I'm in the second year of the MPA program. So my question is about sort of the lasting impact of the reforms you were able to implement in the organizations that you've worked at. So obviously you were able to establish some quite drastic changes, but there's obviously the risk of how well they can sort of last and be replicated in really volatile environments. So was that kind of a focus for you in your work in ensuring that you established the kind of systems and structures to ensure the changes would sort of be there for future generations? And you might also have some perhaps reflections on organizations you've since left and how you've seen your changes sort of last under new leadership and new staff.
Thank you, Grace. I think the biggest legacies that we can establish as leaders are to do with establishing systems that will outlast you, systems that will outlive you. Building the human resource is good, but human resource changes, people change, people move on. But the systems that we build as leaders should be resilient enough to sustain the long haul of the organization. New leaders coming in desiring to change, desiring to maintain change, desiring to take it to the next level, should be able to work within those systems, but also improve them to take the organizations to even more progress. But having said that, as a leader, I have no guarantee. I have no guarantee that everything that I'd want to be sustained will be sustained, especially in an environment where there are a lot of variables. There are a lot of variables, there are a lot of different situations that may come up. So we can build the systems, build the teams, and to a good extent, have something for the next leaders to work along. I know that the systems, for example, we built in the Uganda Revenue Authority over 15 years ago have grown to phenomenal levels. The institution is doing even much more than it did while we were there. And the same basic systems still remain. I'm hoping that the system that we built in Kampala will also stand the test of time and that they will be grown to even yield more for the people of the city and the country.
Thanks, Jennifer. I had another question. So we are a school of public policy. We want to create transformational public leaders. How do we create those? How do we teach them public leadership, support them, and both here and possibly afterwards also? What do you suggest?
I think it has a lot to do with your own inspiration. The training, the teaching enhances what you already are set to do, if that makes sense. For example, just before I started my first job after university, I made a decision and told myself I'd never take a bribe in public office. And I made that decision way, way before the opportunity to receive bribes came. And I also made a decision that I'll do my best to improve whatever was given to me. Now, the training and the experience came after that. I desired to make a difference. I desired to make a contribution, to have impact on my country, on nation. So I think good leadership, therefore, partially comes from your own personal drive and motivation, which is enhanced with the great leadership training that is offered at LSE and other management and leadership institutions. That's the experience that you go along. But of course, even having conversations with some of us that have been in leadership, where we could share our experience, we could also share our pitfalls so that the upcoming leaders avoid them. We could help mentor future leaders and upcoming leaders. And a combination, really a combination of effort would help to grow good leaders. I don't think there's a one size fits all leadership training package. A lot of adjustments are done depending on the situation you're thrown in. For example, a lot of my colleagues that I've met over the years from other jurisdictions do not have rampant corruption as we have to deal with in our own settings. But they have other challenges that we do not perhaps have in Uganda and in Africa. So the leadership quality is enhanced by the situations that you're dealing with and the ability to navigate whatever storms or challenges that come with that situation and overcome them successfully and be able to make progress and produce good results. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense, but that's also not the easiest of things. So that's our challenge of how best to create an enabling environment for to be able to achieve that. So I think we are now coming to the end of our session. So let me, so on behalf of Andres, Jemima, the entire student body, we're very grateful, honored, and delighted that you could make it, you could join us today. We'll share your experiences and insights. It was a great pleasure for all of us. We very much hope that we'll keep on engaging with you, that we'll hopefully we'll see you in person here. We tried that last year, but unfortunately, both last year and this year, because of these unique circumstances, we couldn't host you, but hopefully in a future day. And we also expect to see greater things, more successful things, more productive things coming from your end, things that you achieve